Well, good morning. This is Jeff Blankford, welcoming you to the April 8th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phone to you, our listeners. Today is one day short of the 67th anniversary of one of the defining events in the now decades-old Israel-Palestine conflict. Early in the morning of April 9th, 1948, 5 weeks before Israel declared statehood, commanders of the Irgun Zvi Lumai, headed by Menachem Begin, attacked Deir Yassin, a Palestinian village outside of Jerusalem, with about 750 Palestinian residents, slaughtering more than 100 of them. Then they dragged survivors through the streets of the old holy city to demonstrate to Palestinians in other villages what fate awaited them if they didn't flee. The village lay outside of the area to be assigned by the UN to the Jewish state and had a peaceful reputation, but it was located on high ground in the corridor between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, and the Jewish leadership in Palestine wanted it. It was the worst, but not just, well, just one of many terrorist acts committed by the Irgun under Begin's leadership, the most notable being the blowing up of the King David Hotel in Jerusalem in 1947, which killed 97 people, most of them British soldiers. In December 1948, on the eve of a visit by the Polish-born Begin to the United States, 10 prominent Jewish intellectuals, headed by Albert Einstein and Hannah Arendt, sent a letter to the New York Times denouncing Begin as a fascist and warning those who welcomed him to be aware of his political philosophy. Quote, "Among the most disturbing political phenomena of our times," the letter began, "is the emergence in the newly created State of Israel of the Freedom Party, Tenuat Harut, a political party closely akin in its organization, methods, political philosophy, and social appeal to the Nazi and Fascist parties. It was formed," the letter noted, "out of the membership and following of the former Irgun Zvi Lumai, a terrorist right-wing chauvinist organization in Palestine. The current visit of Menachem Begin, leaders of this party, to the United States is obviously calculated to give the impression of American support for his party in the coming Israeli elections and to cement political ties with conservative Zionist elements in the United States," end quote. That was a letter in the New York Times signed by Albert Einstein and Hannah Arendt and eight other Jewish intellectuals. 3 decades later, Begin would become Israel's prime minister, but like the leopard, he didn't change his spots. Why this is significant for Americans today is that Benjamin Netanyahu, who is just elected to his fourth term as Israel's prime minister, stems from the same party as Begin, as was Netanyahu's father before him. If the Republicans had their way, he would be their president. It's not just me saying that. That's according to leading neocon and Fox News talking head Bill Kristol, co-founder of the Project for New American Century, its successor, the Foreign Policy Initiative, and more recently, the Emergency Committee for Israel. It makes the situation he and his fellow pro-Israel neocons have created in this country, with the assistance of the Supreme Court and its decision to erase all limits on campaign spending, more ominous than at any moment in my memory. The person who will be my guest today, Todd Pierce, a retired major in the U.S. Army Judge Advocate Corps, seems to share my opinion. His recent article in Consortium News, titled "Neocons, the Echo of German Fascism," is the most important piece of political analysis I have read in many years, and I wanted to have him share his thoughts with you. That's what he'll be doing 20 minutes past the hour. First, I want to give you a taste of what to expect. He writes, quote, "The F word for fascist keeps cropping up in discussing aggressive U.S. and Israeli exemptionalism," he writes. But there's a distinction from the N word for Nazi. This new form of ignoring international law fits more with an older form of German authoritarianism favored by neocon icon Leo Strauss," end quote. That's a brief introductory paragraph to his essay. He goes on to write, "With the Likud Party's electoral victory in Israel, the Republican Party is on a roll, having won 2 major elections in a row. The first was winning control of the U.S. Congress last fall. The second is a victory by the Republicans' de facto party leader, Benjamin Netanyahu, in Israel's recent election. Quote, as the Israeli prime minister puts together a coalition with other parties, in the national camp, as he describes them, meaning the ultra-nationalist parties of Israel, it would be a coalition that today's Republicans would feel right at home in. The common thread linking Republicans and Netanyahu's national camp, Pierce points out, is a belief of each in their country's exceptionalism, with a consequent right of military intervention whenever their commander-in-chief orders it, as well as the need for oppressive laws to suppress dissent. William Crystal, he writes, neoconservative editor of the Weekly Standard, would agree. He notes, celebrating Netanyahu's victory, Crystal told the New York Times, quote, it will strengthen the hawkish types in the Republican Party. Crystal added that Netanyahu would win the GOP's nomination if he could run because, quote, Republican primary voters are at least as hawkish as the Israeli public, end quote. Again, we'll hear more from Todd Pierce at 20 minutes past the hour. Crystal is currently one of the more aggressive participants in the Israeli-neocons full-court attack on the negotiations with Iran designed to curtail its nuclear program. If one is looking for a fifth column in U.S. politics, they're it. In his latest editorial in the Weekly Standard, one of the flagship publications, Crystal notes that, quote, commentators have exposed how bad the Iran deal is in various ways. The point, however, is to kill it. Why, he asks? Because the deal can't be fixed. Even if sanctions relief were somewhat more gradual, even if the number of centrifuges were somewhat lower, even if the inspection regime were somewhat more robust, the basic factors would remain. Iran gets to keep its nuclear infrastructure, including the most sensitive parts of it. The sanctions come off, and the inspectors can be kicked out. So Iran, a state sponsor of terror, writes Crystal, an enemy of the United States, an aggressive jihadist power, a regime dedicated to the destruction of Israel, will become a threshold nuclear weapon state, end quote. We'll move on from Crystal's hyperbole and distortion of the facts and see what the ubiquitous Dennis Ross, advisor to four presidents, including Obama, and now counselor to the Washington Institute, an AIPAC spawn think tank, has to say. Here's Ross, quote, the deal should clearly lay out how the United States will respond if the agreement is violated. This is true for the sunset provision as well. The administration must make clear that if Iran begins to rebuild a full-scale nuclear program after the deal expires, Washington will not preclude responding with military force, end quote. In the Israeli-occupied Senate, the attacks on the deal were no less intense, and the network and cable news shows were quick to hand them the battlefield. Arkansas Republican Senator Tom Cotton, whose $1 million gift from Crystal's Emergency Committee for Israel paved the way to his victory last November, vowed Friday to keep a framework agreement from materializing. Quote, I'm going to do everything I can to stop these terms from becoming a final deal, Cotton said on Friday to CNN, noting it's unclear whether the deal would attempt to lift international sanctions. He suggested lawmakers could counter the administration's effort by not allowing congressionally mandated sanctions to be waived, imposing new sanctions, and pushing for legislation allowing Congress to review any deal reached with Iran. Cotton is taking credit for having initiated the letter of 47 senators to the government of Iran, promising to revoke any deal made by Obama once he leaves office. There's Senator Bob Corker, chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He's one of the handful of Republicans who didn't sign Cotton's letter, but he said Sunday that any deal concerning Iran's nuclear program should have to get through Congress, which would examine it inside and out, as the framework for an Iran accord was too important for President Obama to handle without help. He said a stronger deal for national security in the U.S. could come with congressional input, much like the sanctions that brought Iran to the bargaining table in the first place. The American people want someone to tease out all the details of this deal, Corker said on Fox News Sunday. Apparently for Corker, Fox News viewers are the American people. The nastiest comment came from South Carolina's Lindsey Graham, who said Sunday on CBS's Face the Nation that President Obama was not qualified to deal with Iran and its nuclear arms ambitions. Graham claimed U.S. allies in the Middle East do not trust Obama with their interest and that Iran itself neither fears nor respects the president. Obama's a flawed negotiator, said Graham, ignoring the fact that Obama has not taken part in the negotiations. I don't want a war, but I also don't want to give Iran the tools to attack the Middle East and one day us, he continued. I believe there is a better deal. It's the best deal Barack Obama could get, however, he concluded. Does anyone really believe the Iranians will take the billions of dollars we give them and build hospitals and schools? Well, those billions were, in fact, Iran's to begin with, and Tehran is more likely to build hospitals and schools with that money than Graham and his fellow senators. Well, there was a sigh of relief in some quarters when Cuban-born New Jersey Democrat Robert Menendez, and a major recipient of pro-Israel money, was recently indicted for corruption by the Justice Department and forced to step down as a ranking Democrat on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Menendez was committed to applying new sanctions on Iran and had co-sponsored new sanctions legislation with Republican Mark Kirk from Illinois that is due to come before the committee on April 14th. It's questionable, however, whether the next Democrat in line on the committee, Maryland's Ben Cardin, will be any improvement. Like Menendez, Cardin, who is Jewish, is one of a dozen senators on the advisory committee of the Israel Project, a seven-year-old organization dedicated to propagandizing the media on Israel's behalf. According to the Israel Project site, it offers, quote, real-time background information, images, maps, audio, video, graphics, and direct access to newsmakers. That's Israeli newsmakers. It also, quote, organizes press briefings and speaker tours, conference calls, and educational trips. And like every other American organization working on Israel's behalf, it's not required to register as a foreign agent. As a top new Democrat on the Foreign Relations Committee, Cardin will be considering two separate measures next week that would put President Obama's nuclear framework deal with Iran in jeopardy. And you wonder why members of Congress are on the advisory board of a pro-Israel lobbying organization. And then we have the case of New York's well-respected Charles Schumer, who is set to take the place of Nevada's Harry Reid as a Senate Minority Leader when Reid retires at the end of his term. Yesterday, Schumer let it be known that he will be joining the Republicans in calling for congressional review of the sanctions deal. Quote, he's from Schumer, "This is a very serious issue that deserves careful consideration, and I expect to have a classified briefing in the near future," he told Politico, the magazine, in an email statement. "I strongly believe Congress should have the right to disapprove any agreement, and I support the Corker bill, which would allow that to occur," end quote. Schumer quietly signed on to a bill allowing congressional review of the Iran deal 2 weeks ago, but made little fanfare of his co-sponsorship. I would offer another reason for Schumer's betrayal of the president and of the country. Several years ago, when interviewed on a Jewish radio station in New York City, Schumer bragged that his name, Schumer, meant defender of Israel, and he made a similar statement before AIPAC's National Convention in 2010. He apparently believes his commitment to Israel trumps his commitment to the U.S. Constitution and to the American people. Well, he's not alone in that, of course, but he may be the first to publicly say it. I should mention again that after the next election, he will be the Democratic Party's leader in the Senate. Netanyahu, of course, has ready access to the U.S. media, and that is without precedent for any other foreign leader. On Sunday, he appeared on NBC, ABC, and CNN, but this time he took a different approach, claiming that it was the U.S. that was in danger from Iran as much as Israel. On all three networks, Netanyahu warned that Iran's intercontinental ballistic missiles system, ICBMs, an issue not addressed in the deal, was more of a threat to the U.S. than to Israel. To NBC, Netanyahu said, quote, "They're developing ICBMs to reach the United States. Don't give them these weapons. Don't give them nuclear ICBMs with which they can threaten you," end quote. On CNN, the Israeli prime minister insisted that the deal, quote, "keeps Iran's vast nuclear infrastructure in place, not a single centrifuge destroyed, not a single nuclear facility shut down, including the underground facilities that they built illicitly. Thousands of centrifuges will keep spinning, enriching uranium. That's a very bad deal," unquote. "They're getting a free path to the bomb," he said. Well, Netanyahu ignored and, of course, was not asked about the leaked Mossad report of 2012, that contradicted his dramatic presentation at the UN when, brandishing a cartoon of a bomb with a red line to illustrate his point, he warned that Iran would be able to build nuclear weapons the following year, that would be 2013, and called for action to halt the process. A secret Mossad report shared with South Africa a few weeks after Netanyahu's speech concluded that Iran was, quote, "not performing the activity necessary to produce a weapon," end quote, and apparently Mossad has not changed its position. Why don't we hear or read about that in the mainstream media on NPR, and why isn't Netanyahu asked about it? Well, on Monday back in Israel, Yuval Steinitz, he's the country's intelligence and strategic affairs minister, presented to the International Press Corps a list of modifications he says are needed to make a final deal with Iran more accessible to Israel. Among the requirements, according to the New York Times, is ending Iranian research and development on advanced centrifuges, closing the underground Fordo facility, requiring Iran to disclose past nuclear activities with military uses, and requiring Iran to allow nuclear inspectors into the country anytime, anywhere. End quote. Steinitz also handed out a list of 10 questions to the media intended to illustrate the extent of the irresponsible concessions given to Iran. That's his quotes. What they illustrate, in fact, is Israel's arrogance and contempt for the media, its spokesperson knowing full well they won't be asked any hard questions. Even asking two of the questions was a display of chutzpah by Steinitz. In both, if Israel is substituted for Iran, a lively conversation at the very least would ensue. Question two said, quote, given Iran's track record of concealing illicit nuclear activities, why does the framework not explicitly require Iran to accept inspections of all installations where suspected nuclear weapons development has been conducted? And then why can't inspectors conduct inspections anywhere, anytime? And question three, will Iran ever be forced to come clean about its past nuclear weaponization activity? Both of these questions need to be asked of Israel. Why haven't they? You'll remember that perhaps John Kennedy demanded inspections of Israel's nuclear facility because he didn't want Israel to have the bomb. And they did all kind of trickery, creating false laboratories in order to fool President of the United States, John Kennedy, who was against Israel adamantly getting a nuclear weapon. Well, we know what happened to him. Okay, on my next program, I plan to get a guest who will talk about how the U.S., Israel, and Saudi Arabia are now backing al-Qaeda in Syria and Yemen. That's right. Israel, the United States, and the Saudis are now on the side of al-Qaeda because their enemies are Assad in Syria and the Houthi, who are a Shia sect in Yemen.